Part 3. The Art of Deduction. Chapter 5. Navigating the Brain Attic. Deduction from the Facts. Imagine you are Holmes, and I, Maria, a potential client. You've spent the last 100-odd pages being presented with information, much as you would if you were to observe me in your sitting room for some time. Take a minute to think. To consider what you may know about me as a person. What can you infer based on what I've written? I won't go down a list of all possible answers, but here's one to make you pause. The first time I ever heard the name Sherlock Holmes was in Russian. Those stories my dad read by the fire? Russian translations, not English originals. You see, we had only recently come to the United States. And when he read to us, it was in the language that my family uses to this day with one another at home. Alexander Dumas, Sir H. Rider Haggard, Jerome K. Jerome, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, all men whose voices I first heard in Russian. What does this have to do with anything? Simply this. Holmes would have known without my having to tell him. He would have made a simple deduction based on the available facts, infused with just a bit of that imaginative quality we spoke about in the last chapter. And he would have realized that I couldn't have possibly had my first encounter with his methods in any language but Russian. Don't believe me? All of the elements are there, I promise. And by the end of this chapter, you too should be in a position to follow Holmes in putting them together into the only explanation that would suit all of the available facts. As the detective says over and over, when all avenues are exhausted, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. And so we turn finally to that most flashy of steps, deduction. The grand finale. The fireworks at the end of a hard day's work. The moment when you can finally complete your thought process and come to your conclusion. Make your decision. Do whatever it was that you had set out to do. Everything has been gathered and analyzed. All that remains is to see what it all means and what that meaning implies for you, to draw the implications out to their logical conclusion. It's the moment when Sherlock Holmes utters that immortal line in The Crooked Man. Elementary. "I have the advantage of knowing your habits, my dear Watson," said he. "When your round is a short one, you walk, and when it is a long one, you use a hansom. As I perceive that your boots, although used, are by no means dirty, I cannot doubt that you are at present busy enough to justify the hansom." "Excellent," I cried. "Elementary," said he. "It is one of those instances where the reasoner can produce an effect which seems remarkable to his neighbor, because the latter has missed the one little point which is the basis of the deduction. What does deduction actually entail? Deduction is that final navigation of your brain attic, the moment when you put together all of the elements that came before in a single, cohesive whole that makes sense of the full picture. The attic yielding in orderly fashion what it has gathered so methodically. What Holmes means by deduction and what formal logic means by deduction are not one and the same. In the purely logical sense, deduction is the arrival at a specific instance from a general principle. Perhaps the most famous example, all men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Socrates is mortal. But for Holmes, this is but one possible way to reach the conclusion. His deduction includes multiple ways of reasoning. As long as you proceed from fact and reach a statement that must necessarily be true, to the exclusion of other alternatives. Whether it's solving a crime, making a decision, or coming to some personal determination, the process remains essentially the same. You take all of your observations, those attic contents that you've decided to store and integrate into your existing attic structure, and that you've already mulled over and reconfigured in your imagination. You put them in order, starting from the beginning and leaving nothing out. And you see what possible answer remains that will both incorporate all of them and answer your initial question. Or to put it in Holmesian terms, you lay out your chain of reasoning and test possibilities until whatever remains, improbability aside, is the truth. That process starts upon the supposition that when you have eliminated all which is impossible, then whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth, he tells us. It may well be that several explanations remain, in which case one tries test after test until one or other of them has a convincing amount of support. That, in essence, is deduction, or what Holmes calls systemized common sense. But the common sense is not as common or as straightforward as one might hope. Whenever Watson himself tries to emulate Holmes, he often finds himself in error, and it's only natural. Even if we've been accurate up to this point, we have to push back one more time, lest System Watson lead us astray at the 11th hour. Why is deduction far more difficult than it appears? Why is it that Watson so often falters when he tries to follow in his companion's footsteps? What gets in the way of our final reasoning? Why is it so often so difficult to think clearly, even when we have everything we need to do so? And how can we circumvent those difficulties so that, unlike Watson, who is stuck to repeat his mistakes over and over, we can use System Holmes to help us out of the quagmire and deduce properly? Indeed, some of his deduction would, in logic's terms, be more properly called induction or abduction. All references to deduction or deductive reasoning use it in the Holmesian sense, and not the formal logic sense. The difficulty of proper deduction. Our inner storyteller at the wheel. A trio of notorious robbers sets its sight on Abbey Grange, the residence of Sir Eustace Brackenstall, one of the richest men in Kent. One night, when all are presumed to be sleeping, the three men make their way through the dining room window, preparing to ransack the wealthy residence much as they did a nearby estate a fortnight prior. Their plan, however, is foiled when Lady Brackenstall enters the room. Quickly, they hit her over the head and tie her to one of the dining room chairs. All would seem to be well were it not for Sir Brackenstall, who comes in to investigate the strange noises. He is not so lucky as his wife. He is knocked over the head with a poker and collapses. He is knocked over the head with a poker, and he collapses, dead, onto the floor. The robbers hastily clear the sideboard of its silver, but too agitated by the murder to do much else, exit thereafter. But first, they open a bottle of wine to calm their nerves. Or so it would seem, according to the testimony of the only living witness, Lady Brackenstall. But in The Adventure of the Abbey Grange, few things are what they appear to be. The story seems sound enough. The lady's explanation is confirmed by her maid, Teresa, and all signs point to events unfolding much in the manner she has described. And yet, something doesn't feel right to Sherlock Holmes. "Every instinct that I possess cries out against it," he tells Watson. "It's wrong. It's all wrong. I'll swear that it's wrong." He begins enumerating the possible flaws, and as he does so, details that seem entirely plausible, when taken one by one, now together begin to cast doubt on the likelihood of the story. It is not, however, until he comes to the wine glasses that Holmes knows for sure he is correct. "And now, on top of this, comes the incident of the wine glasses," he says to his companion. "Can you see them in your mind's eye?" "I see them clearly." "We are told that three men drank from them. Does that strike you as likely?"
"Why not? There was wine in each glass."
"Exactly. But there was bee's wing only in one glass. You must have noticed that fact. What does that suggest to your mind?"
"That last glass filled would be most likely to contain bee's wing."
"Not at all. The bottle was full of it, and it is inconceivable that the first two glasses were clear and the third heaving charged with it. There are two possible explanations, and only two. One is that after the second glass was filled, the bottle was violently agitated, and so the third glass received the bee's wing. That does not appear probable. No, no, I am sure that I am right."
"What then do you suppose?"
"That only two glasses were used, and that the dregs of both were poured into a third glass, so as to give the false impression that three people had been there." What does Watson know about the physics of wine? Not much, I venture to guess. But when Holmes asks him about the B-swing, he at once comes up with a ready answer. It must have been the last glass to be poured. The reason seems sensible enough, and yet comes from nowhere. I'd bet that Watson hadn't even given it so much as a second thought until Holmes prompted him to do so. But when asked, he is only too happy to create an explanation that makes sense. Watson doesn't even realize that he has done it. And were Holmes not to stop him for a moment, he would likely hold it as a future fact, as further proof of the veracity of the original story, rather than as a potential hole in the story's fabric. Absent Holmes, the Watson storytelling approach is the natural, instinctive one. And absent Holmes's insistence, it is incredibly difficult to resist our desire to form narratives, to tell stories, even if they may not be altogether correct or correct at all. We like simplicity. We like concrete reasons. We like causes. We like things that make intuitive sense, even if that sense happens to be wrong. On the flip side, we dislike any factor that stands in the way of that simplicity and causal concreteness. Uncertainty, chance, randomness, non-linearity. These elements threaten our ability to explain, and to explain quickly and seemingly logically. And so, we do our best to eliminate them at every turn. Just like we decide that the last glass of wine to be poured is also most likely to contain all the bee's wing if we see glasses of uneven clarity, we may think, to take one example, that someone has a hot hand in basketball if we see a number of baskets in a row. The hot hand fallacy. In both cases, we are using too few observations to reach our conclusions. In the case of the glasses, we rely only on that bottle and not on the behavior of other similar bottles under various circumstances. In the case of basketball, we rely only on the short streak, the law of small numbers, and not on the variability inherent in any player's game, which includes long-run streaks. Or, to take another example, we think a coin is more likely to land on heads if it has fallen on tails for a number of times, the gambler's fallacy, forgetting that short sequences don't necessarily have to have the 50-50 distribution that would appear in the long term. Whether we're explaining why something has happened or concluding as to the likely cause of an event, our intuition often fails us because we prefer things to be much more controllable, predictable, and causally determined than they are in reality. From these preferences stem the errors in thinking that we make without so much as a second thought. We tend to deduce as we shouldn't, arguing, as Holmes would put it, ahead of the data, and often in spite of the data. When things just make sense, it is incredibly difficult to see them any other way. W.J. was a World War II veteran. He was gregarious, charming, and witty. He also happened to suffer from a form of epilepsy so incapacitating that in 1960, he elected to have a drastic form of brain surgery. The connecting fabric between the left and right hemispheres of the brain that allows the two halves to communicate, his corpus callosum, would be severed. In the past, this form of treatment had been shown to have a dramatic effect on the incidence of seizures. Patients who had been unable to function could all of a sudden lead seizure-free lives. But did such a dramatic change to the brain's natural connectivity come at a cost? At the time of W.J.'s surgery, no one really knew the answer. But Roger Sperry, a neuroscientist at Caltech who would go on to win a Nobel Prize in Medicine for his work on hemispheric connectivity, suspected that it might. In animals, at least, a severing of the corpus callosum meant that the hemispheres became unable to communicate. What happened in one hemisphere was now a complete mystery to the other. Could this effective isolation occur in humans as well? The pervasive wisdom was an emphatic no. Our human brains were not animal brains. They were far more complicated, far too smart, far too evolved, really. And what better proof than all of the high-functioning patients who had undergone the surgery? This was no frontal lobotomy.
These patients emerged with IQ intact and reasoning abilities aplenty. Their memory seemed unaffected. Their language abilities were normal. The resounding wisdom seemed intuitive and accurate. Except, of course, it was resoundingly wrong. No one had ever figured out a way to test it scientifically. It was a Watson just-so story that made sense, founded on the same absence of verified factual underpinnings. Until, that is, the scientific equivalent of Holmes arrived at the scene. Michael Gazzaniga, a young neuroscientist in Sperry's lab. Gazzaniga found a way to test Sperry's theory that a severed corpus callosum rendered the brain hemispheres unable to communicate with the use of a tachistoscope, a device that could present visual stimuli for specific periods of time, and, crucially, could do this to the right side or the left side of each eye separately. This lateral presentation meant that any information would go to only one of the two hemispheres. When Gazzaniga tested WJ after the surgery, the results were striking. The same man who had sailed through his tests weeks earlier could no longer describe a single object that was presented to his left visual field. When Gazzaniga flashed an image of a spoon to the right field, WJ named it easily. But when the same picture was presented to the left, the patient seemed to have, in essence, gone blind. His eyes were fully functional, but he could neither verbalize nor recall having seen a single thing. What was going on? WJ was Gazzaniga's patient zero, the first in a long line of initials who all pointed in one direction. The two halves of our brains are not created equal. One half is responsible for processing visual inputs. It's the one with a little window to the outside world, if you recall the Shel Silverstein image. But the other half is responsible for verbalizing what it knows. It's the one with the staircase to the rest of the house. When the two halves have been split apart, the bridge that connects the two no longer exists. Any information available to one side may as well not exist as far as the other is concerned. We have, in effect, two separate mind attics, each with its unique storage, contents, and, to some extent, structure. And here's where things get really tricky. If you show a picture of, say, a chicken claw to just the left side of the eye, which means the picture will be processed only by the right hemisphere of the brain, the visual one with the window, and one of a snowy driveway to just the right side of the eye, which means it will be processed only by the left hemisphere, the one with the communicating staircase, and then ask the individual to point at an image most closely related to what he's seen, the two hands don't agree. The right hand, tied to the left input, will point to a shovel, while the left hand, tied to the right input, will point to a chicken. Ask the person why he's pointing to two objects, and instead of being confused, he'll at once create an entirely plausible explanation. You need a shovel to clean out the chicken coop. His mind has created an entire story, a narrative that will make plausible sense of his hand's discrepancy, when in reality, it all goes back to those silent images. Gazzaniga calls the left hemisphere our left brain interpreter, driven to see causes and explanations, even for things that may not have them, or at least not readily available to our minds, in a natural and instinctive fashion. But while the interpreter makes perfect sense, he is more often than not flat out wrong. The Watson of the wine glasses taken to an extreme. Split-brain patients provide some of the best scientific evidence of our proficiency at narrative self-deception, at creating explanations that make sense but are in reality far from the truth. But we don't even need to have our corpus callosum severed to act that way. We do it all the time, as a matter of course. Remember that pendulum study of creativity where subjects were able to solve the problem after the experimenter had casually set one of the two cords in motion? When subjects were then asked where their insight had come from, they cited many causes. It was the only thing left. I just realized the cord would swing if I fastened a weight to it. I thought of the situation of swinging across a river. I had imagery of monkeys swinging from trees. All plausible enough. None correct. No one mentioned the experimenter's ploy. And even when told about it later, over two-thirds continued to insist that they had not noted it and that it had had no impact at all on their own solutions, although they had reached those solutions, on average, within 45 seconds of the hint. What's more, even the one-third that admitted the possibility of influence proved susceptible to false explanation. When a decoy cue, twirling the weight on a cord, was presented, which had no impact on the solution, they cited that cue, and not the actual one that helped them, as having prompted their behavior. Our minds form cohesive narratives out of the disparate elements all the time. We're not comfortable if something doesn't have a cause, and so our brains determine a cause one way or the other, without asking our permission to do so. When in doubt, our brains take the easiest route, and they do so at every stage of the reasoning process, from forming inferences to generalizations. WJ is but a more extreme example of the exact thing that Watson does with the wine glasses. In both instances, there is the spontaneous construction of story, and then a firm belief in its veracity, even when it hinges on nothing more than its seeming cohesiveness. That is deductive problem number one. Even though all of the material is there for the taking, the possibility of ignoring some of it, knowingly or not, is real. Memory is highly imperfect and highly subject to change and influence. Even our observations themselves, while accurate enough to begin with, may end up affecting our recall and hence our deductive reasoning more than we think. We must be careful lest we let something that caught our attention, whether because it is all out of proportion, salience, or because it just happened, recency, or because we've been thinking about something totally unrelated, priming or framing, weigh too heavily in our reasoning and make us forget other details that are crucial for proper deduction. We must also be sure that we answer the same question we posed in the beginning, the one that was informed by our initial goals and motivation, and not one that somehow seems more pertinent or intuitive or easier now that we've reached the end of the thought process. Why do Lestrade and the rest of the detectives so often persist in wrongful arrests, even when all evidence points to the contrary? Why do they keep pushing their original story as if failing to note altogether that it is coming apart at the seams? It's simple, really. We don't like to admit our initial intuition to be false and would much rather dismiss the evidence that contradicts it. It is perhaps why wrongful arrests are so sticky, even outside the world of Conan Doyle. The precise mistakes or the names we give them don't matter as much as the broad idea. We often aren't mindful in our deduction, and the temptation to gloss over and jump to the end becomes ever stronger the closer we get to the finish line. Our natural stories are so incredibly compelling that they are tough to ignore or reverse. They get in the way of Holmes's dictate of systemized common sense, of going through all alternatives, one by one, sifting the crucial from the incidental, the improbable from the impossible, until we reach the only answer. As a simple illustration of what I mean, consider the following questions. I want you to write down the first answer that comes to your mind. Ready? 1. A bat and a ball cost $1.10 in total. The bat costs $1 more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? 2. If it takes 5 machines 5 minutes to make 5 widgets, how long would it take 100 machines to make 100 widgets? 3. In a lake, there is a patch of lily pads. Every day the patch doubles in size. If it takes 48 days for the patch to cover the entire lake, how long would it take for the patch to cover half of the lake? You have just taken Shane Frederick's Cognitive Reflection Test, CRT. If you are like most people, chances are you wrote down at least one of the following. 10 cents for question 1, 100 minutes for question 2, and 24 days for question 3. In each case, you would have been wrong. But you would have been wrong in good company. When the questions were asked of Harvard students, the average score was 1.43 correct, with 57% of students getting either 0 or 1 right. At Princeton, a similar story, 1.63 correct, and 45% scoring 0 or 1. And even at MIT, the scores were far from perfect. 2.18 correct on average, with 23% or near to a quarter of students getting either none or one correct. These simple problems are not as straightforward as they may seem at first glance. The correct answers are 5 cents, 5 minutes, and 47 days, respectively. If you take a moment to reflect, you will likely see why, and you'll say to yourself, "Of course, how did I ever miss that?" Simple. Good old System Watson is won out once again. The initial answers are the intuitively appealing ones, the ones that come quickly and naturally to mind if we don't pause to reflect. We let the salience of certain elements, and they were framed to be salient on purpose, draw us away from considering each element fairly and accurately. We use mindless verbatim strategies, repeating an element in the prior answer and not reflecting on the actual best strategy to solve the present problem instead of mindful ones. In essence, substituting an intuitive question for the more difficult and time-consuming alternative, just because the two happen to seem related. Those second answers require you to suppress System Watson's eager response and let Holmes take a look. To reflect, inhibit your initial intuition, and then edit it accordingly, which is not something that we are overly eager to do, especially when we are tired from all the thinking that came before. It's tough to keep that motivation and mindfulness going from start to finish, and far easier to start conserving our cognitive resources by letting Watson take the helm. While the CRT may seem far removed from any real problems we might encounter, it happens to be remarkably predictive of our performance in any number of situations where logic and deduction come into play. In fact, this test is often more telling than our measures of cognitive ability, thinking disposition, and executive function. Good performance on these three little questions predicts resistance to a number of common logical fallacies, which, taken together, are considered to predict adherence to the basic structures of rational thought. The CRT even predicts our ability to reason through the type of formal deductive problem, the Socrates one, that we saw earlier in the chapter. If you do poorly on the test, you are more likely to say that if all living things need water, and roses need water, it follows that roses are living things. Jumping to conclusions, telling a selective story instead of a logical one, even with all of the evidence in front of you and well sorted, is common, though avoidable, as you'll see in just a moment. Reasoning through everything up until the last moment, not letting those mundane details bore you, not letting yourself peter out toward the end of the process, that is altogether rare. We need to learn to take pleasure in the lowliest manifestations of reason, to take care that deduction not seem boring or too simple after all of the effort that has preceded it. That is a difficult task. In the opening lines of The Adventure of the Copper Beeches, Holmes reminds us, "To the man who loves art for its own sake, it is frequently in its least important and lowliest manifestations that the keenest pleasure is to be derived. If I claim full justice for my art, it is because it is an impersonal thing, a thing beyond myself. Crime is common. Logic is rare. Why? Logic is boring. We think we've already figured it out. In pushing past this preconception lies the challenge. Learning to tell the crucial from the incidental. So how do you start from the beginning and make sure that your deduction is going along the right track and has not veered fabulously off course before it has even begun? In The Crooked Man, Sherlock Holmes describes a new case, the death of Sergeant James Barclay, to Watson. At first glance, the facts are strange indeed. Barclay and his wife Nancy were heard to be arguing in the morning room. The two were usually affectionate, and so the argument in itself was something of an event. But it became even more striking when the housemaid found the door to the room locked and its occupants unresponsive to her knocks. Add to that a strange name that she heard several times, David, and then the most remarkable fact of all. After the coachman succeeded in entering the room from outside through the open French doors, no key was to be found. The lady was lying insensible on the couch. The gentleman dead, with a jagged cut on the back of his head and his face twisted in horror. And neither one possessed the key that would open the locked door. How to make sense of these multiple elements? "Having gathered these facts, Watson," Holmes tells the doctor, "I smoked several pipes over them, trying to separate those which were crucial from others which were merely incidental. And that, in one sentence, is the first step toward successful deduction. The separation of those factors that are crucial to your judgment from those that are just incidental, to make sure that only the truly central elements affect your decision. Consider the following descriptions of two people, Bill and Linda. Each description is followed by a list of occupations and avocations. Your task is to rank the items in the list by the degree that Bill or Linda resembles the typical member of the class. Bill is 34 years old. He is intelligent but unimaginative, compulsive, and generally lifeless. In school, he was strong in mathematics, but weak in social studies and humanities. Bill is a physician who plays poker for a hobby. Bill is an architect. Bill is an accountant. Bill plays jazz for a hobby. Bill is a reporter. Bill is an accountant who plays jazz for a hobby. Bill climbs mountains for a hobby. Linda is 31 years old, single, outspoken, and very bright. She majored in philosophy. As a student, she was deeply concerned with issues of discrimination and social justice, and also participated in anti-nuclear demonstrations. Linda is a teacher in an elementary school. Linda works in a bookstore and takes yoga classes. Linda is active in the feminist movement. Linda is a psychiatric social worker. Linda is a member of the League of Women Voters. Linda is a bank teller. Linda is an insurance salesperson. Linda is a bank teller and is active in the feminist movement. After you've made your ranking, take a look at two pairs of statements in particular. Bill plays jazz for a hobby, and Bill is an accountant who plays jazz for a hobby. And Linda is a bank teller, and Linda is a bank teller and is active in the feminist movement. Which of the two statements have you ranked as more likely in each pair? I am willing to bet that it was the second one in both cases. If it was, you'd be with the majority, and you would be making a big mistake. This exercise was taken verbatim from a 1983 paper by Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman to illustrate our present point. When it comes to separating crucial details from incidental ones, we often don't fare particularly well. When the researchers' subjects were presented with these lists, they repeatedly made the same judgment that I've just predicted you would make, that it was more likely that Bill was an accountant who plays jazz for a hobby than it was that he plays jazz for a hobby, and that it was more likely that Linda was a feminist bank teller than that she was a bank teller at all. Logically, neither idea makes sense. A conjunction cannot be more likely than either of its parts. If you didn't think it likely that Bill played jazz or that Linda was a bank teller to begin with, you should not have altered that judgment just because you did think it probable that Bill was an accountant and Linda a feminist. An unlikely element or event when combined with a likely one does not somehow magically become any more likely. And yet 87% and 85% of participants, for the Bill scenario and the Linda scenario respectively, made that exact judgment, in the process committing the infamous conjunction fallacy. They even made it when their choices were limited. If only the two relevant options, Linda is a bank teller or Linda is a feminist bank teller, were included, 85% of participants still ranked the conjunction as more likely than the single sentence. Even when people were given the logic behind the statements, they sided with the incorrect resemblance logic. Linda seems more like a feminist, so I will say it's more likely that she's a feminist bank teller, over the correct extensional logic. Feminist bank tellers are only a specific subset of bank tellers, so Linda must be a bank teller with a higher likelihood than she would be a feminist one in particular, in 65% of cases. We can all be presented with the same set of facts and figures, but the conclusions we draw from them need not match accordingly. Our brains weren't made to assess things in this light, and our failings here actually make a good amount of sense. When it comes to things like chance and probability, we tend to be naive reasoners. And as chance and probability play a large part in many of our deductions, it's no wonder that we often go astray. It's called probabilistic incoherence, and it all stems from that same pragmatic storytelling that we engage in so naturally and readily, a tendency that may go back to a deeper neural explanation, to, in some sense, WJ and the split brain. Simply put, while probabilistic reasoning seems to be localized in the left hemisphere, deduction appears to activate mostly the right hemisphere. In other words, the neural loci for evaluating logical implications and those for looking at their empirical plausibility may be in opposite hemispheres, a cognitive architecture that isn't conducive to coordinating statement logic with the assessment of chance and probability. As a result, we aren't always good at integrating various demands, and we often fail to do so properly, all the while remaining perfectly convinced that we have succeeded admirably. The description of Linda and feminist and Bill an accountant coincides so well that we find it hard to dismiss the match as anything but hard fact. What is crucial here is our understanding of how frequently something occurs in real life, and the logical, elementary notion that a whole simply can't be more likely than the sum of its parts. And yet, we let the incidental descriptors color our minds so much that we overlook the crucial possibilities. What we should be doing is something much more prosaic. We should be gauging how likely any separate occurrence actually is. In Chapter 3, I introduce the concept of base rates, or how frequently something appears in the population, and promise to revisit it when we discuss deduction. And that's because base rates, or our ignorance of them, are at the heart of deductive errors like the conjunction fallacy. They hamper observation, but where they really throw you off is in deduction, in moving from all of your observations to the conclusions they imply. Because here, selectivity and selective ignorance will throw you off completely. To accurately cast Bill and Linda's likelihood of belonging to any of the professions, we need to understand the prevalence of accountants, bank tellers, amateur jazz musicians, active feminists, and the whole lot in the population at large. We can't take our protagonists out of context. We can't allow one potential match to throw off other information we might have. So how does one go about resisting this trap, sorting the details properly instead of being swept up in irrelevance? Perhaps the pinnacle of Holmes's deductive prowess comes in a case that is less traditional than many of his London pursuits. Silver Blaze, the prize-winning horse of the story's title, goes missing days before the big Wessex Cup race, on which many a fortune ride. That same morning, his trainer is found dead some distance from the stable. His skull looks like it has been hit by some large, blunt object. The lackey who had been guarding the horse has been drugged and remembers precious little of the night's events. The case is a sensational one. Silver Blaze is one of the most famous horses in England. And so, Scotland Yard sends Inspector Gregson to investigate. Gregson, however, is at a loss. He arrests the most likely suspect, a gentleman who has been seen around the stable the evening of the disappearance, but admits that all evidence is circumstantial and that the picture may change at any moment. And so, 3 days later, with no horse in sight, Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson make their way to Dartmoor. Will the horse run the race? Will the trainer's murderer be brought to justice? 4 more days pass. It is the morning of the race. Silver Blaze, Holmes assures the worried owner, Colonel Ross, will run, not to fear. And run he does. He not only runs, but wins. And his trainer's murderer is identified soon thereafter. We'll be returning to Silver Blaze several times for its insights into the science of deduction. But first, let's consider how Holmes introduces the case to Watson. "It is one of those cases," says Holmes, "where the art of the reasoner should be used rather for the sifting of details than for the acquiring of fresh evidence. The tragedy has been so uncommon, so complete, and of such personal importance to so many people that we are suffering from a plethora of surmise, conjecture, and hypothesis. In other words, there is too much information to begin with, too many details to be able to start making them into any sort of coherent whole, separating the crucial from the incidental. When so many facts are piled together, the task becomes increasingly problematic. You have a vast quantity of your own observations and data, but also an even vaster quantity of potentially incorrect information from individuals who may not have observed as mindfully as you have. Holmes puts the problem this way. The difficulty is to detach the framework of fact, of absolute, undeniable fact, from the embellishments of theorists and reporters. Then, having established ourselves upon this sound basis, it is our duty to see what inferences may be drawn and what are the special points upon which the whole mystery turns. In other words, in sorting through the morass of Bill and Linda, we would have done well to set clearly in our minds what were the actual facts and what were the embellishments or stories of our minds. When we pry the incidental and the crucial apart, we have to exercise the same care that we spent on observing to make sure that we have recorded accurately all of the impressions. If we're not careful, mindset, preconception, or subsequent turns can affect even what we think we observed in the first place. In one of Elizabeth Loftus's classic studies of eyewitness testimony, participants viewed a film depicting an automobile accident. Loftus then asked each participant to estimate how fast the cars were going when the accident occurred, a classic deduction from available data. But here's the twist. Each time she asked the question, she subtly altered the phrasing. Her description of the accident varied by verb. The cars smashed, collided, bumped, contacted, or hit. What Loftus found was that her phrasing had a drastic impact on subjects' memory. Not only did those who viewed the smashed condition estimate a higher speed than those who viewed the other conditions, but they were also far more likely to recall, 1 week later, having seen broken glass in the film, even though there was actually no broken glass at all. It's called the misinformation effect. When we are exposed to misleading information, we are likely to recall it as true and to take it into consideration in our deductive process. In the Loftus experiment, the subjects weren't even exposed to anything patently false, just misleading. All the specific word choice does is act as a simple frame that impacts our line of reasoning and even our memory. Hence, the difficulty and the absolute necessity that Holmes describes of learning to sift what is irrelevant and all that is media conjecture from the real, objective, hard facts, and to do so thinkingly and systematically. If you don't, you may find yourself remembering broken glass instead of the intact windshield you actually saw. In fact, it's when we have more, not less, information that we should be most careful. Our confidence in our deductions tends to increase along with the number of details on which we base them, especially if one of those details makes sense. A longer list somehow seems more reasonable, even if we were to judge individual items on that list as less than probable, given the information at hand. So when we see one element in a conjunction that seems to fit, we are likely to accept the full conjunction, even if it makes little sense to do so. Linda, the feminist bank teller. Bill, the jazz-playing accountant. It's perverse, in a way. The better we've observed and the more data we've collected, the more likely we are to be led astray by a single governing detail. Similarly, the more incidental details we see, the less likely we are to home in on the crucial, and the more likely we are to give the incidental undue weight. If we are told a story, we are more likely to find it compelling and true if we are also given more details, even if those details are irrelevant to the story's truth. Psychologist Ruma Falk has noted that when a narrator adds specific, superfluous details to a story of coincidence, for instance, that two people win the lottery in the same small town, listeners are more likely to find the coincidence surprising and compelling. Usually, when we reason, our minds have a tendency to grab any information that seems to be related to the topic, in the process, retrieving both relevant cues and those that seem somehow to be connected but may not actually matter. We may do this for several reasons. Familiarity, or a sense that we've seen this before, or should know something even when we can't quite put our finger on it. Spreading activation, or the idea that the activation of one little memory node triggers others. And over time, the triggered memory spread further away from the original. Or simple accident or coincidence. We just happen to think of something while thinking about something else. If, for example, Holmes were to magically emerge from the book and ask us, not Watson, to enumerate the particulars of the case at hand, we'd rummage through our memory. What did I just read? Or was that the other case? Take certain facts out of storage. Okay, horse gone, trainer dead, lackey drugged, possible suspect apprehended. Am I missing anything? And in the process, likely bring up others that may not matter all that much. I think I forgot to eat lunch because I was so caught up in the drama. It's like that time I was reading The Hound of the Baskervilles for the first time and forgot to eat, and then my head hurt, and I was in bed, and... If the tendency to overactivate and overinclude isn't checked, the activation can spread far wider than is useful for the purpose at hand, and can even interfere with the proper perspective needed to focus on that purpose. In the case of Silver Blaze, Colonel Ross constantly urges Holmes to do more, look at more, consider more, to leave, in his words, no stone unturned. Energy and activity, more is more. Those are his governing principles. He is supremely frustrated when Holmes refuses, choosing instead to focus on the key elements that he has already identified. But Holmes realizes that to weed out the incidental, he should do anything but take in more and more theories and potentially relevant, or not, facts. We need, in essence, to do just what the CRT teaches us. Reflect, inhibit, and edit. Plug system Holmes in. Check the tendency to gather detail thoughtlessly, and instead focus, thoughtfully, on the details we already have. All of those observations? We need to learn to divide them in our minds in order to maximize productive reasoning. We have to learn when not to think of them, as well as when to bring them in. We have to learn to concentrate, reflect, inhibit, edit. Otherwise, we may end up getting exactly nowhere on any of the myriad ideas floating through our heads. Mindfulness and motivation are essential to successful deduction. But essential never means simple, nor does it mean sufficient. Even with Silver Blaze, Holmes, as focused and motivated as he is, finds it difficult to sift through all of the possible lines of thought. As he tells Watson once Silver Blaze is recovered, I confess that any theories which I had formed from the newspaper reports were entirely erroneous. And yet, there were indications there, had they not been overlaid by other details which concealed their true import. The separation of crucial and incidental. The backbone of any deduction can be hard for even the best trained minds. That's why Holmes doesn't run off based on his initial theories. He first does precisely what he urges us to do. Lay the facts out in a neat row and proceed from there. Even in his mistakes, he is deliberative and Holmes-like, not letting System Watson act, though it may well want to. How does he do this? He goes at his own pace, ignoring everyone who urges haste. He doesn't let anyone affect him. He does what he needs to do. And beyond that, he uses another simple trick. He tells Watson everything. Something that occurs with great regularity throughout the Holmes canon. And you thought it was just a clever expository device. As he tells the doctor before he delves into the pertinent observations, nothing clears up a case so much as stating it to another person. It's the exact same principle we've seen in operation before. Stating something through, out loud, forces pauses and reflection. It mandates mindfulness. It forces you to consider each premise on its logical merits and allows you to slow down your thinking so that you do not blunder into a feminist Linda. It ensures that you do not let something that is of real significance go by simply because it didn't catch your attention enough or fit with the casual story that you have, subconsciously, no doubt, already created in your head. It allows your inner Holmes to listen and forces your Watson to pause. It allows you to confirm that you've actually understood, not just thought you understood because it seemed right. Indeed, it is precisely in stating the facts to Watson that Holmes realizes the thing that will allow him to solve the case. It was while I was in the carriage, just as we reached the trainer's house, that the immense significance of the curried mutton occurred to me. The choice of a dinner is easy to mistake for triviality until you state it along with everything else and realize that the dish was perfectly engineered to hide the smell and taste of powdered opium, the poison that was used on the stable boy. Someone who didn't know the curried mutton was to be served would never risk using a poison that could be tasted. The culprit, then, is someone who knew what was for dinner. And that realization prompts Holmes to his famous conclusion. Before deciding that question, I had grasped the significance of the silence of the dog, for one true inference invariably suggests others. Start on the right track, and you are far more likely to remain there. While you're at it, make sure you are recalling all of your observations, all of the possible permutations that you've thought up in your imaginative space, and avoiding those instances that are not part of the picture. You can't just focus on the details that come to mind most easily, or the ones that seem to be representative, or the ones that seem to be most salient, or the ones that make the most intuitive sense. You have to dig deeper. You would likely never judge Linda a likely bank teller from her description, though you very well might judge her a likely feminist. Don't let that latter judgment color what follows. Instead, proceed with the same logic that you did before, evaluating each element separately and objectively as part of a consistent whole. A likely bank teller? Absolutely not. And so, a feminist one? Even less probable. You have to remember, like Holmes, all of the details about Silver Blaze's disappearance, stripped of all of the paper's conjectures and the theories your mind may have inadvertently formed as a result. Never would Holmes call Linda a feminist bank teller unless he was first certain that she was a bank teller. The improbable is not impossible. In The Sign of Four, a robbery and murder are committed in a small room, locked from the inside, on the top floor of a rather large estate. How in the world did the criminal get inside to do the deed? Holmes enumerates the possibilities. "The door has not been opened since last night," he tells Watson. "Window is snibbed on the inner side. Framework is solid. No hinges at the side. Let us open it. No water pipe near. Roof quite out of reach. Then how to possibly get inside?" Watson ventures a guess. "The door is locked. The window is inaccessible." "Was it through the chimney?" "No," Holmes tells him. "The grate is much too small. I had already considered that possibility." "How then?" asks an exasperated Watson. "You will not apply my precept." Holmes shakes his head. "How often have I said to you that when you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth? We know that he did not come through the door, the window, or the chimney. We also know that he could not have been concealed in the room, as there is no concealment possible. Whence, then, did he come?" And then at last, Watson sees the answer. "He came from the hole in the roof." And Holmes's reply, "Of course he did. He must have done so," makes it seem the most logical entrance possible. It isn't, of course. It is highly improbable. A proposition that most people would never consider, just as Watson, trained as he is in Holmes's approach, failed to do without prompting. Just like we find it difficult to separate the incidental from the truly crucial, so too we often fail to consider the improbable, because our minds dismiss it as impossible before we even give it its due. And it's up to System Homes to shock us out of that easy narrative and force us to consider that something as unlikely as a rooftop entrance may be the very thing we need to solve our case. Lucretius called a fool someone who believes that the tallest mountain that exists in the world and the tallest mountain he has ever observed are one and the same. We'd probably brand someone who thought that way foolish as well. And yet, we do the same thing every single day. Author and mathematician Nassim Taleb even has a name for it, inspired by the Latin poet, the Lucretius underestimation. And back in Lucretius's day, was it so strange to think that your world was limited to what you knew? In some ways, it's smarter than the mistakes we make today, given the ease of knowledge at our disposal. Simply put, we let our own personal past experience guide what we perceive to be possible. Our repertoire becomes an anchor of sorts. It is our reasoning starting point, our place of departure for any further thoughts. And even if we try to adjust from our egocentric perspective, we tend not to adjust nearly enough to matter, remaining stubbornly skewed in a self-directed approach. It's our storytelling proclivity in another guise. We imagine stories based on the ones we've experienced, not the ones we haven't. Learning of historical precedent as well matters little, since we don't learn in the same way from description as we do from experience. It's something known as the description-experience gap. Perhaps Watson had read at one time or another about a daring rooftop entrance, but because he has never had direct experience from it, he will not have processed the information in the same way and is not likely to use it in the same manner when trying to solve a problem. Lucretius's fool? Having read of high peaks, he may still not believe they exist. "I want to see them with my own two eyes," he'll say. What am I, some kind of fool? Absent a direct precedent, the improbable seems so near impossible that Holmes's maxim falls by the wayside. And yet distinguishing the two is an essential ability to have. For even if we have successfully separated the crucial from the incidental, even if we've gathered all of the facts and their implications and have focused on the ones that are truly relevant, we are lost if we don't let our minds think of the roof, however unlikely it is, as a possible entry point into a room. If, like Watson, we dismiss it out of hand or fail to even think about, we will never be able to deduce those alternatives that would flow directly from our reasoning if only we'd let them. We use the best metric of the future, the past. It's natural to do, but that doesn't mean it's accurate. The past doesn't often make room for the improbable. It constrains our deduction to the known, the likely, the probable. And who is to say that the evidence, if taken together and properly considered, doesn't lead to an alternative beyond these realms? Let's go back for a moment to Silver Blaze. Sherlock Holmes emerges triumphant, it's true. The horse is found, as is the trainer's murderer, but not after a delay that is uncharacteristic of the great detective. He is late to the investigation, 3 days late, to be specific, losing valuable time at the scene. Why? He does just what he reprimands Watson for doing. He fails to apply the precept that the improbable is not yet the impossible, that it must be considered along with the more likely alternatives. As Holmes and Watson head to Dartmoor to help with the investigation, Holmes mentions that on Tuesday evening, both the horse's owner and Inspector Gregson had telegraphed for his assistance on the case. The flummoxed Watson responds, "Tuesday evening? And this is Thursday morning. Why didn't you go down yesterday?" To which Holmes answers, "Because I made a blunder, my dear Watson, which is, I am afraid, a more common occurrence than anyone would think who only knew me through your memoirs. The fact is that I could not believe it possible that the most remarkable horse in England could long remain concealed, especially in so sparsely inhabited a place as the north of Dartmoor." Holmes has dismissed the merely improbable as impossible and has failed to act in a timely fashion as a result. In so doing, he has reversed the usual Holmes-Watson exchange, making Watson's reprimand uncharacteristically well-warranted and on point. Even the best and sharpest mind is necessarily subject to its owner's unique experience and world perception. While a mind such as Holmes's is, as a rule, able to consider even the most remote of possibilities, there are times when it, too, becomes limited by preconceived notions, by what is available to its repertoire at any given point. In short, even Holmes is limited by the architecture of his brain attic. Holmes sees a horse of exceptional appearance missing in a rural area. Everything in his experience tells him it can't go missing for long. His logic is as follows. If the horse is the most remarkable such animal in the whole of England, then how could it go under the radar in a remote area where hiding places are limited? Surely someone would notice the beast, dead or alive, and make a report. And that would be perfect deduction from the facts, if it happened to be true. But it is Thursday. The horse has been missing since Tuesday, and the report has failed to come. What is it, then, that Holmes failed to take into account? A horse couldn't remain concealed if it could still be recognized as that horse. The possibility of disguising the animal doesn't cross the great detective's mind. If it had, surely he wouldn't have discounted the likelihood of the animal remaining hidden. What Holmes sees isn't just what there is. He is also seeing what he knows. Were we to witness something that in no way fit with past schemas, had no counterpart in our memory, we would likely not know how to interpret it. Or we may even fail to see it altogether, and instead see what we were expecting all along. Think of it as a complex version of any one of the famous Gestalt demonstrations of visual perception, whereby we are easily able to see one thing in multiple ways, depending on the context of presentation. For instance, consider this picture. Do you see the middle figure as a B or a 13? The stimulus remains the same, but what we see is all a matter of expectation and context. A disguised animal? Not in Holmes's repertoire, however vast it might be. And so he does not even consider the possibility. Availability from experience, from contextual frames, from ready anchors, affects deduction. We wouldn't deduce a B if we took away the A and C, just like we'd never deduce a 13 were the 12 and 14 to be removed. It wouldn't even cross our minds, even though it is highly possible, merely improbable given the context. But if the context were to shift slightly, or if the missing row were to be present, only hidden from our view, that would change the picture, but it wouldn't necessarily change the choices we consider. This raises another interesting point. Not only does our experience affect what we consider possible, but so too do our expectations. Holmes was expecting Silver Blaze to be found, and as a result, he viewed his evidence in a different light, allowing certain possibilities to go unexamined. Demand characteristics rear their ugly head yet again. Only this time, they take the guise of the confirmation bias, one of the most prevalent mistakes made by novice and experienced minds alike. From early childhood, we seem to be susceptible to forming confirmatory biases, to deciding long before we actually decide, and dismissing the improbable out of hand as impossible. In one early study of the phenomenon, children as young as third grade were asked to identify which features of sports balls were important to the quality of a person's serve. Once they made up their minds, for instance, size matters but color does not, they either altogether failed to acknowledge evidence that was contrary to their preferred theory, such as the actual importance of color or the lack thereof of size, or considered it in a highly selective and distorted fashion that explained away anything that didn't correspond to their initial thought. Furthermore, they failed to generate alternative theories unless prompted to do so, and when they later recalled both the theory and the evidence, they misremembered the process so that the evidence became much more consistent with the theory than it had been in reality. In other words, they recast the past to better suit their own view of the world. As we age, it only gets worse, or at the very least, it doesn't get any better. Adults are more likely to judge one-sided arguments as superior to those that present both sides of a case, and more likely to think that such arguments represent good thinking. We are also more likely to search for confirming, positive evidence for hypotheses and established beliefs, even when we are not actually invested in those hypotheses. In a seminal study, researchers found the participants tested a concept by looking only at examples that would hold if that concept were correct, and fail to find things that would show it to be incorrect. Finally, we exhibit a remarkable asymmetry in how we weigh evidence of a hypothesis. We tend to overweight any positive confirming evidence and underweight any negative disconfirming evidence, a tendency that professional mind readers have exploited for ages. We see what we are looking for. In these final stages of deduction, System Watson will still not let us go. Even if we do have all the evidence, as we surely will by this point in the process, we might still theorize before the evidence in letting our experience and our notion of what is and is not possible color how we see and apply that evidence. It's Holmes disregarding the signs in Silver Blaze that would point him in the right direction because he doesn't consider it possible that the horse could remain undetected. It's Watson disregarding the roof as an option for entrance because he doesn't consider it possible that someone could enter a room in that fashion. We might have all the evidence, but that doesn't mean when we reason, we'll take into account that all of the evidence is objective, intact, and in front of us. But Holmes, as we know, does manage to catch and correct his error, or have it caught for him, with the failure of the horse to materialize. And as soon as he allows that improbable possibility to become possible, his entire evaluation of the case and the evidence changes and falls into place. And off he and Watson go to find the horse and save the day. Likewise, Watson is able to correct his incomprehension when prompted to do so. Once Holmes reminds him that however improbable something may be, it must still be considered, he right away comes up with the alternative that fits the evidence, an alternative that just a moment ago he had dismissed entirely. The improbable is not yet impossible. As we deduce, we are too prone to that satisficing tendency, stopping when something is good enough. Until we have exhausted the possibilities and are sure that we have done so, we aren't home clear. We must learn to stretch our experience, to go beyond our initial instinct. We must learn to look for evidence that both confirms and disconfirms, and, most important, we must try to look beyond the perspective that is the all-too-natural one to take, our own. We must, in short, go back to that CRT and its steps. Reflect on what our minds want to do. Inhibit what doesn't make sense. Here, asking whether something is truly impossible or merely unlikely. And edit our approach accordingly. We won't always have a Holmes prompting us to do so, but that doesn't mean we can't prompt ourselves through that very mindfulness that we've been cultivating. While we may still be tempted to act first and think later, to dismiss options before we've even considered them, we can at least recognize the general concept. Think first, act later, and try our utmost to approach every decision with a fresh mind. The necessary elements are all there, at least if you've done your observational and imaginative work. The trick is in what you do with them. Are you using all available evidence and not just what you happen to remember or think of or encounter? Are you giving it all the same weight so that you are truly able to sift the crucial from the incidental instead of being swayed by some other altogether irrelevant factors? Are you laying each piece out in a logical sequence where each step implies the next and each factor is taken to its conclusion so that you don't fall victim to the mistake of thinking you've thought it through when you've done no such thing? Are you considering all logical paths, even those that may seem to you to be impossible? And finally, are you focused and motivated? Do you remember what the problem was that got you there in the first place? Or have you been tempted off course or off to some other problem without really knowing how or why? I first read Sherlock Holmes in Russian because that was the language of my childhood and of all of my childhood books. Think back to the clues I've left for you. I've told you that my family is Russian, and that both my sister and I were born in the Soviet Union. I've told you that the stories were read to me by my dad. I've told you that the book in question was old, so old that I wondered if his dad had, in turn, read it to him. In what other language could it have possibly been, once you see everything laid out together? But did you stop to consider that as you were seeing each piece of information separately? Or did it not even cross your mind because of its improbability? Because Holmes is just so, well, English. It doesn't matter that Conan Doyle wrote in English, and that Holmes himself is so deeply ingrained in the consciousness of the English language. It doesn't matter that I now read and write in English just as well as I ever did in Russian. It doesn't matter that you may have never encountered a Russian Sherlock Holmes, or even considered the likelihood of his existence. All that matters is what the premises are, and where they take you if you let them unwind to their logical conclusion, whether or not that is the place that your mind has been gearing to go.